and he could be a Yuma gangster, too. Jesus basically said, "What are we waiting for?" Jesus was of regular size, neither tall nor overly heavy. He had a rabbit tattooed on his right arm. And then there was that haircut. His haircut was a classic rockero or banda style. He probably hadn't seen much MTV, but he had seen the Mexican TV shows that featured pop bands like Maná, shows like Control and Caliente. Maybe the gangsters had weenie roasts at the big man's house, and maybe they fired up the satellite dish and watched TRL and Oz and WrestleMania together. Most of the stuff on Sonoran radio was crap. Norteño accordion music and lame cumbias filtered up from the tropics. Jesus didn't look like those groups with their polyester two-tone or even three-tone cowboy suits. He certainly didn't dress like those guys. Jesus looked like El Tri or Molotov. Jesus looked cool. And he liked his music. Music that was getting bolder and bolder. Even the ranchero stuff was turning outlaw. Polkas and ballads sang of the virtues of narcos and coyotes. The culture had common enemies. Oppression, poverty, cops, the government, the border patrol, la migra. Oddly, much border slang made law enforcement feminine. La chota, la placa, la migra. Rock songs regularly took the governments of both the United States and Mexico to task, demanding human rights, indigenous rights, political parity, revolution, even ecological responsibility. Like all rock, some songs also enthusiastically advocated smoking pot, getting drunk, and getting laid. And Jesus and his friends were listening. The banda kids, a terror to the staid fathers of Mexico, were becoming self-educated through a kind of samizdat musical network. Mexican bands, Latin American bands, even Chicano bands from Los Angeles were throwing down challenges in every genre. Pop, rap, techno, metal, el punk. What didn't get on the radio rattled from block party boomboxes and pirated tapes. DJs in chichi bars played the rude stuff to the delight of partiers and the indifference of the strippers. Some of the songs were unbelievably bold. The sly cultural warriors of Tijuana No, for example, released a rousing rap stolen at gunpoint. Fuck la migra and the policía. Fuck John Wayne. I look up to Pancho Villa. The chorus cried, California, stolen at gunpoint. Arizona, stolen at gunpoint. Texas, stolen at gunpoint. Nuevo Mexico, stolen at gunpoint. El Alamo, stolen at gunpoint. Aztlan, stolen at gunpoint. Puerto Rico, stolen at gunpoint. America, stolen at gunpoint. We gonna get it back. Aztlan, the place of the reeds, was the traditional home of the Aztecs, a possibly mythical motherland from which the tribe ventured forth on a 100-year walk. It was a land to the north of Mexico City. Chicanos recognize Aztlan as being in the American Southwest, and it came to represent the stomping ground of La Chicanada, or the entirety of the Hispanic West. The Aztecs, spelled Mexica, pronounced Mexica, hence Chicano, walked south, out of the deserts, on their way to what would become Mexico City. They apparently walked across the Devil's Highway on their way home. We're gonna get it back. In this milieu, it was quite attractive to be a coyote. You could tell yourself you were a kind of civil rights activist, a young Zapata liberator of the poor and the downtrodden, in short, a revolutionary, coyote as Che. Jesus certainly fed himself these ideas if his testimony is to be believed. Being a coyote, even a lowly guía, was also muy macho. Jesus had suddenly gone from being a put-upon poor boy making bricks in the wicked Sonoran heat to being an outlaw. He was Lil Pancho Villa. He had the immense forces of the United States federal government after him. His own government was putting up signs asking him to stop. And he had money. He had a crib. He had a good-looking morra to play house with. He had dangerous men watching his back. He had a cell phone. He had songs being sung about him on the radio and in the cantinas. He even had a patron saint of illegals watching over his endeavor. Toribio Romo was originally a priest from Jalisco. He was shot in one of the many revolts that dot Mexican history. His folk power is ascendant. There are Saint Toribio prayer books that migrants carry with them. There are Saint Toribio t-shirts, religious pictures, and scapulars. And there are tales of Saint Toribio's amazing miracles, heavenly interventions, migrants finding water, migrants escaping certain death, migrants outwitting the migra, lost migrants being delivered unto the pickup point. Selah. The famous immigrant's prayer that graces the St. Toribio's prayer book has even made it into the New York Times. It's a kind of United Nations affirmation. I believe I am a citizen of the world and of a church without borders. See that? No borders. God said so. Vámonos, muchachos. Next stop, Chicago. Another prayer, blessed be the outlaws, living outside the law, was as dizzying as tequila. Jesus went into the desert a boy, and he was led to believe the rigors of El Negro's world would make him a man. The forces arrayed against Jesus and Saint Toribio were formidable. American pundits regularly insist that the border needs to be militarized. In a very real way, much of the Devil's Highway region is militarized. The Barry M. Goldwater Air Force Range sprawls between the Gila Mountains to the far west and the Sand Tank Mountains to the east. One of the mountains on the base, ironically enough, known as Coyote Peak, is a landmark for smugglers. If you make it to Coyote Peak, you're only miles from I-8 and the turgid waters of the irrigation canals. In the east end of the basin, north of the base, a string of mountains known as the ABCs, Antelope, Baker, Copper, lead you north to salvation. But Marines share the vast base with the jet jockeys, and they prowl the desert in camo Humvees. Air National Guard aircraft fly over from Tucson. Helicopters, jets, bombers, UFOs. Beside the bombing range lies the Organ Pipe Cactus National Monument. Organ Pipe has the dubious honor of being known as the most dangerous national park in America. Drug and human smugglers use it as a freeway, and officers are at risk every day of their assignments. Law is represented there by armed rangers and the federal cactus cops, the officers of the Forest Service, Department of the Interior, and Bureau of Land Management. Farther to the east of Organ Pipe is the Tohono O'odham Reservation, patrolled by tribal police. South of Yuma, it's the Kokopah Reservation. Between Yuma and Ajo, it's 150 miles of sheriff's territory. East of this area is the Pinal Air Park, a weird landing strip full of bloated cargo jets that shimmer in the heat waves. Local folklore suggests that Pinal is also home to a CIA airbase. All along the line, the tireless Border Patrol drives, flies, walks. they hit the trails on small ATVs like weekend dune buggy enthusiasts. The heroic Boar Star rescuers hunt for people in trouble. The secretive Boar-Tac SWAT troops, called the Hunter Killers by one Cactus cop, go on their covert missions. A legendary unit of customs flits in and out of the night like ghosts, the Shadow Wolves, Native American trackers who hunt down drug runners. Added to the mix is the DEA, often belittled by local cops. DEA means don't expect anything. BLM cops, and at each border crossing are the border guards, not the Border Patrol wants you to know what they do. INS agents. There are also big angry white men in jeeps, two separate groups of citizen border watchers working the western desert outside of Tucson. And the human rights groups are also wandering around, hoping to save dying walkers and placing water jugs on the trails. Then there are the prospectors, drug smugglers, journalists, scientists, FBI, park rangers, park service cops, BLM agents, military police, ranchers, Indians, outlaw biker gangs. Scattered here and there are small groups of militias and patriot militias, their trailers pulled into secure configurations, upside-down American flags and black MIA POW flags, and the occasional Jolly Roger fluttering in the wind. With so many hunters trying to catch Jesus, it's a wonder he managed to get lost. Jesus and Maradona went to work. The boys stumbled off the bus in the blighted August sun of San Luis. They made their way to the Hotel Rio Colorado, flogged by the brutal heat. Here they took cheap rooms and waited for word from Chespirito. Maradona knew the walking route, east of San Luis, where buses stopped at a restaurant near a Mexican army outpost, but Jesus didn't. The restaurant was probably the famous El Saguaro truck stop, traditional jumping-off point for walkers heading north to Welton, a scene from a B-movie, one of the haunted diners full of Mexican vampires and masked wrestlers, the place revealed in the last shot of the film to be an ancient Chichimeca pyramid hidden in a sewage-crusted arroyo. From the front, its bad walls, white paint, a gas pump, and a soda cooler. The Border Patrol seems to have a strange affection for its tawdriness. In Welton Station, there are several framed shots of the joint in the chief's office. Agents take visitors in there and point to the photos of cracked, dirty walls and say things like, "There's Mecca." People stop here and rest in the heat for a minute, drink a soda, buy a beer, and hike away into the wilderness. The Yuma Desert, the Lechuguilla Desert, the Mohawk Mountains, the Devil's Highway, all lie ahead. Mexican Route 2 runs at their backs. Beyond it, the Black Pinacate. To the north, the bombing range. If they walk for 2 days, they can be at I-8. Maradona walked Jesus down the pathways. Then Chespirito sent the first load of illegals to San Luis. They had orders to find Jesus and Maradona at the Hotel Rio Colorado. Maradona and Jesus had already worked out their contacts with the long-haul Route 2 bus drivers. Now they hustled the illegals to the depot and boarded them onto the bus headed for Sonoita. The driver sold them a special ticket since they weren't going all the way. Each man could ride his bus for 50 pesos. The money slipped into the driver's pocket. He then drove them east, and when he made his scheduled stop at El Saguaro, he pushed the lot of them off in bad farewell. Maradona and Jesus hopped off the bus too, picked up gallon jugs of water, and together the group stepped into the United States. At sunset, they shoved off and the walk went well. It was about 30 miles to Welton or Tacna. Maradona, the old pro, showed Jesus how to navigate by the mountains. They skirted the Copper Mountains, watched for Sheep Mountain, and followed Coyote Wash part of the way. They walked till dawn the first night, and they settled in to rest during the morning of the second day. It was hotter than anyone expected, and they were drinking too much, but Maradona didn't worry. They'd be in sight of lights by nightfall. And they were. They saw the lights after dark, and they orienteered by the glow of the Mohawk radio towers and the vapor lamps of the Mohawk rest areas. They came up over the railroad tracks and hurried to the spigots of the bathrooms, the cool drinking fountains, the flush toilets. Those few with American coins could buy cold Cokes and Snickers bars at the vending machines. Mohawk rest area was already some kind of county fair for that first group. If they'd been Boy Scouts, Maradona and Jesus would have gotten merit badges. They made it their practice to home in on houses and towers in the Welton area. As they trudged toward the freeway, they passed over the irrigation canal carrying Colorado water into the desert. There they might have drunk their fill of fertilizer-polluted green water. Most walkers die a relatively short distance from salvation. Some walkers fall in the canals and drown. It seems to be one of the cruel tricks of the desolation spirits, but it makes brutal sense. Most walkers are fresh and strong at the start of the journey. After a day of baking in the sun, they start to get disoriented. They drink too much water. They're dizzy and weak. By the second or third days, when they need their wits and strength about them, they are near death, and they drop, often reported with sad irony in the press, a few miles or yards or feet from water. A home, a road, or a Border Patrol outpost. This first trip, however, went perfectly. The vans appeared, and the walkers were whisked off to Phoenix. But the Border Patrol was catching on to the Cercas gang's roots. After 2 months, they were getting busted more often, their walks disrupted by the sudden appearances of trucks and spotlights. Those Migra guys made Jesus crazy. The Mexican Migra agents were the worst. Turncoats. Traitors. They hunted down their own people. And they were meaner to the illegals than the gringo Migras were. He did everything he could to avoid their attention. He walked down the loneliest valleys, cut across the darkest washes, and regularly relied on the brush out. He dressed like the pollos, of course, in case he was arrested. If he was, he'd be processed and put on a bus and sent back. He learned quickly to keep his head down and stay quiet. The Tucson Migra had this evil trick they'd pull. They wouldn't chase you if you ran. They'd run along beside you and they'd grab a hunk of your shirt, and you'd be trotting along wondering, what is this? And the pinche Migra would be grinning a little, then bam! He'd shove you to one side as you ran, and you'd smash face first into a sahuaro. Any tree or tall boulder would do, but the sahuaro trick, that really hurt. Yuma was supposed to be a little different, but he didn't intend to find out. Oh, hell no. Jesus never ran. He shuffled along, acted stupid, which they pretty much believed of him anyway. He accepted water and nodded and grinned and said, "Sí, señor," when addressed, as if he respected the Migra. Of course, his name started appearing in Border Patrol reports, but of the thousands of illegals intercepted by the Yuma sector, how many must have come back over and over? Jesus was nothing special. Still, he was becoming visible, and El Negro needed an invisible man. So Jesus and Maradona were sent to Sonoita. Hey, what the hell? It didn't make no never mind to them. They'd been in San Luis a long time, and they'd used it up. Sonoita was just about as fly-blown and podunk as San Luis, but it was something almost new. And there was plenty of work coming out of Altar. The boys had been doing 2 loads a week in San Luis, but in Sonoita and Sasabe, they could probably up that by another 3 loads a month. Plus, the migra didn't know them out there. They might get away with it for a year before anybody noticed. Yeah, man. Orale, vato. No mames, wey. They were ready. And besides, what were they going to do? Tell Chespiro and El Negro no? All they could do was get pumped and packed. Head east to the dead heart. Plug in the headphones and listen to Marilyn Manson as the Sahuaros and volcanoes drifted by. They only had one real concern. They were going to New Desert, to the center of the Devil's Highway. But El Negro had a couple of locals ready to show them the ropes. Nothing to worry about. Jesus and Maradona boarded the same Mexican Route 2 bus they smuggled walkers on. Perhaps one of their bribed drivers was at the wheel. They paid full fare. No doubt the driver's eyebrows rose. Orale, they said. No drop-off today. They got off at El Sahuaro for a coke and a piss, a smoke and some flirting. Then they climbed back on, only starting on their big adventure. Chapter 6 In Sonoita. And here they were, getting off a bus again, whiplashed out of air-conditioned comfort into another brutal desert sunstorm. Jesus and Maradona trudged across Sonoita and took rooms in the Hotel San Antonio. Chespiro had paid for them in advance. He kept a whole section of the hotel rented out for his recent arrivals, the Coyote's chicken coop. They settled in and waited for the call, which came soon enough. A Mexican budget border hotel is not to be confused with a Super 8 or a Hojo's. The rooms are tatty and the carpets, if they exist, are worn. The beds are cheap and occasionally feature little black periods and semicolons that reveal themselves to be hungry bedbugs. No cable, no room service. The bathroom at the end of the hall is all tiles and the toilet is often in the corner of the shower, and the whole thing can be swamped out with a dirty mop. Oaxacas and Marias clean the floors. The toilets won't swallow toilet paper, so the bathrooms feature aromatic whitewashed tin buckets full of tainted rosettes. The locks are busted. Home sweet home. El Negro came for the boys and set them on the path with their teachers, a little fat man known as Santos, and a bad-toothed scrapper known as Lauro. These were not their real names. Later, Jesus claimed he didn't ever know anyone's real name. The new smuggling route was as treacherous as the old. Yuma Sector Border Patrol agents will tell you they patrol the deadliest landscape on Earth. Tucson Sector Border Patrol agents will tell you they do. It's a peculiarity of Arizona. The worse it is, the prouder they get. Kings of nowhere, they each want to claim the crown. To El Negro's boys, it was just more damn desert. Where before they were expected to maneuver north from San Luis to Welton or Tacna or even Dateland, home of the world-famous date milkshake, this new walk was at least 35 and even 65 miles long, depending on whether they were headed for Highway 85 or the big freeway beyond. If they walked straight along the cut trail laid down for them by El Negro's scouts, they could get there in 2 days, 3 at the outside. The detours possible to them extended for several million acres. The few place names they knew were eerie to them. They were in a strange Indian language Jesus didn't recognize. Guvo, Shuchali, Hikiwan. It was the Dark Continent. The land was also rougher here, crumpled and spiked with peaks and mountains. Great wads of landscape reared up all around the path. The Growler Mountains, Mount Ajo, the Bates Mountains, the Granite Mountains, the Puerto Blanco Mountains, Diaz Spire, Twin Peaks, the Sonoita Mountains, the Cipriano Hills, Growler Canyon, Scarface Mountain, the John the Baptist Mountains, the aptly named Diablo Mountains. It's a naturalist's dreamscape for the illegals. It's a litany of doom. The poems on the map read like a dirge, a haunted cowboy ballad. Chico Shuni Wash, Teepee Butte, Locomotive Rock, Gunsight Wash, Pozo Redondo, Copper Canyon, Black Mountain, Pinnacle Peak, Camelback. That's a busy piece of real estate. If God could take an iron to it and flatten out all the creases, there would be a plain the size of West Texas, and in all that land, there were only a couple of tinajas, or natural water tanks, and a very few hidden wells. Pinacate Lava Flow, Tordillo Mountain, Pinta Playa, Choya Pass, Saguaro Gap, Alamo Wash, Gunsight Hills, Burro Gap, Guvo Hills, Montezuma's Head. If they cut east and climbed the Diablos, then went up Estes Canyon, they might have found Bull Pasture Spring. Water tanks hide on the south side of the Puerto Blancos, and on the north slope, they might have found Red Tank's Well. Going northwest up Growler Canyon, they might have found Daniel's Well, or north of that, over Old Scarface and below the Lime Hill Mine, they might have found Bandeja Well. It's a hard slog, even if you're a veteran sign cutter and you know where the water is. You need a U.S. Geological Survey topographical map. The Coyotes, when they had them, drew maps on notebook paper with Bic pens. Their routes were inferred from freeway maps and road atlases, and none of the Coyotes knew where to find a drink. Sonoita was easier to trailblaze than the Devil's Highway. It was a small city, splayed in a northwesterly oblong beside Mexican Route 2 and the Sonoita Arroyo Watercourse. The cemeteries were to the east of town. There was a good paved road to the Lukeville border crossing, and a region between Sonoita and Lukeville was called Hombres Blancos, white men, which gave newcomers a chuckle. Gringos cut south through town on Route 8, heading to the Gulf of California and Puerto Peñasco, or Rocky Point, ski-doo and ocean fishing wonderland. For a small place, Sonoita had plenty of cantinas. It had several discos, and it had the requisite border nudie bars. There were other places of worship, too. Sonoita had been targeted for revival by the great Protestant evangelical movement battling Catholics to a draw all over the north of Mexico. The war was not merely between Catholics and Los Aleluyas. In the Catholic Church itself, there was a schism between traditional Roman observance and the new charismatic Catholicism, which borrowed from the Pentecostal traditions and featured shouting and clapping, folk songs and uproar, prophecy and talking in tongues. Alternatives abounded. Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses, Los Testigos de Jehová, known by local wags as Los Testículos de Jehová, worked the barrios. Karate and kung fu dojos represented Eastern thought. Northern Mexico has a busy Chinese immigrant community, and it was fully represented by its many faiths, including loyal Taoists. The AA Sober Club in town introduced a God as we understood God 12-step spirituality. The healthy occult subculture simmered away in the neighborhoods, from traditional and indigenous curanderas to trance mediums known as materias. Black magic cults worked in the deserts, and Santeria cells worked their mojo. Quranic missionaries were the latest wave to penetrate Mexico. The imams were making their way north, on their way from teaching the Indian kids in Chiapas and Veracruz how to speak and read Arabic. The Baptist missionaries in their little barrio Bible studies knew what they were speaking about when they preached that powers and principalities battled in the air over every sinner's head. Like many border towns, Sonoita offered people better pay than what they could scrape together in the interior. Not all locals had plans to cross the border illegally. The San Antonio Hotel was only one of the inns that set aside rooms for Oaxacas. The rooms were often crammed with 10 or 12 nervous people, and the bill was paid whether there was toilet paper or not. Sheets? Who was going to complain about sheets? The tenants were sometimes in the rooms for only a few hours. Then they were gone. At most, they'd be there a day and a night. Rarely did they last more than two. The hoteliers could have simply kept plain rooms, empty except for a slop bucket in a corner, and they could have gotten full price. Some of them did. Jesus and Maradona camped out in their rooms between training runs, smoked and watched TV and read comic books. They went out at night and drank. During the brutal daylight hours, they squatted and sweated out their hangovers in front of fans. In this middle period, Jesus met his beloved, Celia Mendez. Nobody knows if she worked at the hotel or was visiting for some reason. Later, reports list her as Mrs. Mendez. Maybe she was escaping a failed marriage. In love, Jesus left his hotel digs and moved into Celia's house on Altar. Maradona followed soon after, renting a room down at the dirt end of the street. The runs must have already begun, since Maradona could afford rent. And Jesus, now adopting his beloved's last name as an alias, became Mendez. Mendez and Maradona. It had a nice ring to it. El Negro had the whole thing worked out, a science. The walkers came in by bus, pulling up the long Route 2 from deep in the interior. Mendez, Maradona, Santos, or Lauro met them at their hotels. They either stayed at the San Antonio or the appropriately named El Sol del Desierto, the desert sun. A night or so before the run, they were whisked across the street from the San Antonio to a ramshackle rooming house known as La Casa de los Huéspedes. It was supposed to be a two-story building, but the owners had never gotten around to finishing the top floor, which had become an open tar paper space handy for hanging laundry. It also lent itself to service as a lookout post. This safe house was the province of El Negro. Although he reserved it for them, his clients paid for the privilege of sleeping there. The manager, Nelly Munoz, charged them each 50 pesos per day. The groups were always between 15 and 20 people in size. These loads came through three times in a good week. Easy money for Nelly. The short hotel stay was apparently the last hoop the walkers had to jump through. It was a favorite nightmare of the coyotes that the migra's black-clad Bortec monsters would come out of the sky on ropes, infrared goggles glowing horribly in the night. Sometimes El Negro, in an absurd bit of spy game paranoia, would appear suddenly and quietly order the walkers to rush to Nelly's and hide, there to await further orders. Then he would hurry off in his pickup, casting glances all around, lest he be found out. As if anybody in Sonoita cared. The Saturday before the fatal walk began, Mendez and Maradona had taken a group across the Devil's Highway. It was a long, arduous walk, but it was uneventful. They crossed the Quito Baquito Hills, heading north. Then they cut west and approached Ajo. They stuck to high ground, baffling the Migra's drag system. By walking high, they could only be spotted by cutters scanning with optics or by Migra overflights. The planes were easy enough to evade. This ground was so rough and crooked that all you had to do was squat under a palo verde or a mesquite or hug a creosote. Mexican skin from the air is hard to tell apart from the ground. Knowing this, pilots often just fly in circles looking for telltale points of white. Bones. The bones come right out of hiding, as if the dead feel there's nothing left to lose. The walkers made it over Bluebird Pass, and they could see Ajo as a small cluster of lights in the unmitigated dark velvet of 1 a.m. It always seemed like madness to the clients that the guides were pressing past Ajo. They could see roads and gas stations and stoplights. They could practically smell the hot dogs and beer. But the guías knew better. Ajo was just a sign they were cutting. They got past town, and hours later, they arrived at a water tank beside a paved roadway. This nameless outpost was the El Negro gang's chosen rendezvous. There, the group rested and drank as they waited for the pickup, but instead of their own driver appearing, a border patrol truck found them. Maradona managed to escape with one pollo, running into the scrub. The two men went on to Phoenix. Mendez and his group of 12 were apprehended. One of the border patrol guys saw that Mendez had a rabbit tattoo on his arm. "What's that supposed to mean?" he asked. "What?" "The rabbit."
"The tattoo?"
"Yes, the tattoo. What does the rabbit tattoo signify?"
"Nothing."
"Gang sign?"
"No."
"Is it some kind of coyote code?"
"It's a rabbit. I like rabbits."
If the Migra had realized who they had in the holding pen, the Yuma 14 might be alive today. But somehow, Mendez wasn't recognized. They were looking for Jesus Lopez Ramos from San Luis, not some rabbit Mendez of Sonoita. Another disturbing element of this bust was the water tank itself. Once it had been discovered by the Border Patrol, it was compromised. Forever after, the life-saving water stop would represent a game of roulette. Among these arrested walkers were three brothers from the state of Guerrero: Mario González Manzano, Efraín González Manzano, and Isidro González Manzano were from a small village near Chilpancingo called Villa Grande. Their family home did not have telephone service. They had gone to the Coyote's men in Guerrero, south of Mexico City, and sought passage to the north. There wasn't enough money in the family to take care of one brother, much less all three, and the elders and the young ones. The Coyotes put them on a bus for Tijuana, where they were going to cross into San Diego. They were repeatedly foiled by Operation Gatekeeper. "Pinche Migra!" An associate had called Chespiro Cercas on the cell phone and made a case for them. They were good boys, hard workers. They deserved another shot at the border. Just to prove they were good boys, they'd all taken menial jobs in Baja California. They weren't wasting a minute without earning something. Brothers were good, a working unit that the Cercas gang could control. Each brother could be threatened or hurt if need be, but if they worked well together, they'd be earning big. If they got into a yearly trip, they'd owe Chespiro money forever. Chespiro ordered that they be shipped to San Luis. And then, after that didn't work out, they mounted the famous bus to Sonoita and tried again.
bus after bus after bus. They must have thought El Norte was nothing but bus lines. The brothers had been living in crap motel rooms for weeks, and now they'd been caught. They were angry. Enough was enough. They demanded yet another shot at it, and soon. El Negro, in an uncharacteristic spasm of humanitarianism, offered them the next walk, May 19th, for their trouble. Orale, the brothers said. They shook hands. Back at the safe house, Nelly's rooms were getting full. El Negro was looking to sign up 30 walkers for the trip. 30 was some sort of magic limit to the coyotes. Few groups ever grew to that limit. There were practical reasons for this. Large groups were harder to control, and they were very hard to hide. The Gonzalez brothers nodded and muttered hello and crammed themselves into the already stifling rooms of Nelly's house of ghosts. Down in Veracruz, Don Moy and his boys were on their way. The walkers had left their towns in pickup trucks or small regional buses. They gathered at the bus terminal and boarded the bus Don Moy had rented for them, a charter. They felt like millionaires. El Norte. It was a trip of over 2,000 miles. The bus was long and fairly modern, a long-haul cruise liner with two toilets in the back, tandem drivers who traded off sleep shifts as they drove. These highway behemoths were known as doce ruedas because they were powered by 12-wheel drives. The bodies of the big cruisers were split level, with a set of steps behind the driver leading into the interior, a tinted sunroof above the seats. Behind the driver, there was a bench seat where chatty passengers could sit sideways and talk as they stared out the vast front windshield. Raimundo Jr. spent time there, watching the landscape roll by. Poor people carried their own food on buses. Families boarded the bus with white paper packages of tortillas, small pots of beans, slabs of yellow cheese, candied yams and cactus, camotes, and biznagas. They made tortas of bolillo rolls and ham and chiles. These meals were often better than the food available in the roadside taco stands and in the dusty bus terminals along the way. Several of the Moy crew carried lunch bundles. Their few possessions were tucked overhead in the racks above their seats. They toyed with the reading lights and the recliner buttons. The toilets in the back were some of the first flushers some of them had used. Laughter. Some small prayers muttered in discreet whispers, the sign of the cross ending in kissed crossed fingers. Journey mercies. Let us arrive safely. We need to get to the border. Help us get into the desert. Make us strong. It was more comfortable than the chairs in their homes, but the air conditioning was too cold. All roads led to Tenochtitlan. Mexico City is the hub. The big roads converge here and disperse in all directions. The boys gawked as they approached the great city. Few of them had ever seen anything like this. The occult volcano El Popo rose in snowy splendor as the bus came down through pine-covered slopes that could have been in Colorado. The filthy high tide of pollution met the road in the mountains, and the orange mist moved among dying trees like fog. As they dropped into the overpopulated valley, El Popo was gradually erased from sight. The sky turned gold, and the light that hit the streets was brown. Endless grids of buildings spilled into the distance. Thousands of old green VWs, Mexico City's taxis, jostled for position. Traffic jammed tight at intersections. They watched for the fabled UFOs of the city, Los OVNIs, but it was too hazy to see the sky. They saw a great white roller coaster known in Spanish as a Russian mountain beside the highway, and into the bus terminal, and the wait for the drive north, a cigarette, a Coke, a candy bar, a quick piss in the stinking troughs in the big restrooms. Buses headed north can catch Highway 57 through San Luis Potosí, or 15 that cuts across country to Guadalajara. Sooner or later, they get on 45, and this heads northwest to Ciudad Juárez. In the old days, before the Migra closed it down, El Paso Juárez was a target destination. Now, they had to move west. They saw many wonders as they traveled north. In some of their ancient beliefs, north was the direction of death. North was the home of winter, and the underworld could be found there. They went from jungle to rainforest to pine forest, from pines to plains, and from plains to desert and volcanoes. They gawked at the worms of snow on the highest peaks. They stared at the pine trees, the roadside deer. The big cities were no more amazing than the dry lands they entered, the maguey and burros of the heartland, the cacti and plains of the north. The ones who knew geography told the others where they were, the states with the strange names, Zacatecas, Chihuahua. They passed through 100 towns, a scattering of cities. They crossed little rivers, watched 1,000 beaten cafes and gas stations whip by, burned out hulks of ancient car wrecks, white crosses erected along the highway where their ancestral travelers had perished. The whole way was a ghost road, haunted by tattered spirits left on the thirsty ground, drivers thrown out windows, revolutionaries hung from cottonwoods or shot before walls, murdered women tossed in the scrub. Into the Sierra Madre Occidental, the opposite side of their continent. It was a dream of speed for men who had not sped before. An avalanche of details and bafflements. Army patrols in green trucks. Dead donkeys bloated to the point of exploding beside the road. Armadillos. Empty broken white buildings. Crippled children writhing in their chairs and taking the afternoon sun in small dust-smoked town squares. Walls whitewashed and painted blue, red, peach, green. A black freight train struggling toward Durango, seemingly covered in old oil, heavy as a mountain, as it scraped down the rails. Mexican towns full of Mexicans, so like them, yet so different from Veracruz. Aguascalientes, but they saw no hot water anywhere. Víctor Rosales, but who was he? Why did they name a town after him? Fresnillo, or the little ash tree, whipped by, but they saw no Fresnos beside the road. Or were they those distant trees? Oye, güey, ¿es ese un Fresno? ¿Quién sabe? Allí, cabrón, ese árbol. ¿Cómo chingas, güey? No jodes. No mames, ya pues, pendejo. No me vengas con pendejadas. Fresnillos, bésame el culillo. Naum looked out the window, silent. His seat companions shook their heads and went back to sleep. Don Moy didn't like all the hilarity. He preferred to remain invisible. He never knew when the Mexican immigration police were cooperating with the gringos. He dreaded federales and dark cells where the boot and the electric wire hooked to the testicles were the rule. Better to keep quiet and get the job done. High spirits were a bad precedent. This wasn't a vacation. They slept sitting up. Brothers leaned against brothers. The boy slept tucked against his father, his gray comic books in his lap. Loners leaned against the windows, pulled their billed caps over their eyes and tried to nap, keeping their shoulder away from their snoring neighbors. The nude women in the crumpled magazines splayed themselves and made promises no one could keep. In the Alarma crime tabloid, pictures of dead illegals didn't even make the front cover unless they'd been dismembered by a train. They were inside, among the suicides and the human fingers found in bottles of salsa in border diners. They were so passé they didn't even merit color. Cuencamé, Pedriseña, Dinamita, a town named after dynamite. There was nothing delicious in delicias. Nombre de Dios, the name of God, lay in the terrible outland. New languages began to assert themselves. Nahuatl was far behind them now. Strange Chichimeca names floated by. Meoki, Julimes, Coyame. They saw a sign for a place called Cuchillo Parado, the erect knife. There was laughter over that in the bus. Nudge, nudge, is your knife erect? That's not a knife, brother. That's a machete. You may have a machete, my friend, but in my family, we have samurai swords. That thing, where I come from, that's a toothpick. Ciudad Juarez, large in Mexican myth, second only to Tijuana in their minds, the wetback's promised land, was a sprawl of towers and dust, desert and trains. Nothing there, not a tree, it looked like, not a drop of water. The Rio Grande, known to them as El Rio Bravo. Don Moy pointed out El Paso, Texas, some dark peaks, more warehouses. Where? Across the river. That's a river? They couldn't see the Rio Grande. They could see Mexican freight trains, black mountains, and they could see the endlessly rushing traffic of I-10 on the American side. They didn't know that this same freeway far in the west would be their ultimate destination. Weary, sleepy, some of them feeling sick from the bad food and the constant jiggling, they headed west. They were driving parallel to the Devil's Highway, at times only yards from the U.S. border. It just looked like more Mexico. Agua Prieta, Cananea, Altar, where Don Moy made his call to Chespiro and was told to bring him on in to Sonoita. Caborca. Finally, they arrived in Sonoita, heat and horns, street dogs, and northern odors. Another sad, dust-dry desert town. They were hustled off the bus and rushed to the motel. They fell about the dark rooms and slept fitfully. In the morning, the legendary Negro roused them and sent them scurrying to Nelly's safe house to wait. Be ready, they were told. We'll come for you, and you'll have to jump. Nobody knew how long the preparations would take. 50 pesos here, 50 pesos there. They were just bleeding money. Don Moy didn't make it to Nelly's. By the time they wondered where he was on the bus, heading home. Chapter 7. The Pepsi for the Apocalypse. Saturday, May 19th. It is easy to imagine Mendez's morning. Oh, shit. The alarm clock's going off too early. 6 o'clock. Last night was Friday. Party night. Dancing with Celia. Drinks. Cigarettes and laughter. Up too late with the gang. Too late. Too tipsy to make love. Saturday mornings suck. Headache. Mouth tastes foul. Celia still in bed, her hair scattered over the pillow. On the radio, El Gran Silencio, singing Los Chuntaros del Barrio. A small lizard scuttles across the wall, one of the little desert geckos. Mendez scratches himself and gets up, puts on his ugly walking clothes, brushes his teeth, careful not to swallow the tainted city water. Pees in the low toilet, its water barely there from lack of pressure. The tin can in the corner full of wadded toilet paper. Digs around in Celia's fridge for something to eat, stirs some instant coffee into boiling water. He's always careful to boil it fully so he won't get sick. Otherwise, it's bottled water only, and that gets too expensive. And where's that pinche Maradona? It's 7, that lazy bastard. A tortilla heated on the blue flame of the stove, a smear of frijoles and salt. Water and gas come in old trucks that regularly clank down his street. The gas for the house comes from a whitewashed or silver tank sitting on a small cement pad out back. Several of the neighbors still have outhouses and use buckets and wash basins. It's a noisy barrio. When the mailman comes, he blows a loud whistle to let them know he's there. Traffic cops blow whistles. So do kids. Everybody's blowing a pinche whistle. Sellers hawk their wares as ice cream carts jangle by with their little bells. And the newspaper man hollers, and the corncob man trundles along, shouting, and the weirder salesmen of obscure items parade through. Goat cheek tacos, broiled tripe, and tejuino, fermented maize Indian brew. Old-timers say tejuino is fermented by taking a chunk of human shit and wrapping it in a cloth and letting it fester in the mashed corn. Dogs bark. Old buses gulp and grind through the gears. Beat pickups with loose tailpipes roar. Kids yell. Even roosters crow down among the tattered banana trees of that blue and white house where the blacktop ends. Pop, pop. Pop! Some pendejo is already setting off firecrackers. Either that, or some drunk is shooting his wife. The street is already hot. Man, it was 89 degrees all night. Mendez feels bad. He's already sweaty. He takes his morning crap, trying to get his bowels empty so he doesn't have to worry about it on the trail. Hard to keep the pollos in line when they've seen you squat in a bush. He opens the window and sits and looks out at the deceptive green of the backyards of Sonoita. Calculates his profits. Perhaps, for a moment, he dreams of far Guadalajara and his mother, hoping he will someday build her a home. He's not scared. Not anymore. But he's always apprehensive. And it's a pain in the ass, this hiking in the desert. You'd be stupid not to worry about the walk. Bids farewell to his woman. Steps outside, works his baseball cap down over his roquero forelock, slips on his shades. Sonoita smells like bad fruit and sewage. Blue clouds of exhaust leak from the dying cars. He walks down to Maradona's and pounds on the door. No answer. What the hell? He calls out a few friendly insults.
Oye, huevón! Pinche güey! Órale, pendejo! Levántate, cabrón!
But Maradona's apparently gone. Either that or he's so drunk, Mendez can't wake him. Damn! Door's locked. Windows too dark and grimy to see through. Mendez will always wonder what happened to his homeboy. Having started his pollero career in Nogales, Maradona has regularly walked the pathways to the east and west of Tucson. He's the one who really knows the ajo route. Mendez hits the celly and tells El Negro that Maradona, that puto, isn't in. El Negro can't be happy about that. Woe to Maradona when El Negro has a chat with him. All right, El Negro says, I'll handle it. I'll call Santos and Lauro. Oh, no, not those losers. It says a lot about Maradona that he has to be replaced by two other polleros.